From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we meet a singer who is loved for her interpretations of opera and American popular song. At the age of 72, Eileen Farrell no longer performs before audiences, but she's still recording songs. We'll go back to the days when her parents had a vaudeville act. We'll hear about the radio show she used to host and her five seasons with the Met. Also, AIDS drug development, politics, and profits. We talk with health economist Peter Arno. And jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews a new live album from the Clifford Jordan Big Band. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Bill Clinton introduced Tennessee Senator Al Gore today as his choice for a running mate. In explaining the selection, Clinton cited Gore's strength, intensity, and stature and praised the senator's record on the environment. Clinton told reporters gathered at the Arkansas governor's mansion that he and Gore are the right choice to take on President Bush and Vice President Dan Quayle.
Our people are hurting and our country is slipping behind. We can't afford four more years of an administration without a plan to turn the country around, with a president and a vice president not strong enough and determined enough to make it happen. We have the best plan, and now we have the best ticket.
Gore said that he'd not sought the vice presidency until recently, did not expect to be Clinton's choice for the job.
But I'm here for one simple reason. I love my country, and I believe in my heart that this ticket gives our country the best chance for the change we so desperately need to move forward again.
Political analysts say Clinton's selection of a fellow Southerner indicates the Democrats intend to make the South a key battleground in the upcoming election. Leaders at the Conference on Security and Cooperation in Europe said today that they're prepared to send unarmed observers to monitor a ceasefire in Nagorno-Karabakh. The offer was welcomed by Armenia and Azerbaijan, which have been fighting over the region since 1988. Officials from both the former Soviet republics questioned where peacekeepers might be deployed. Nagorno-Karabakh is an Armenian enclave within the borders of Azerbaijan. The Pentagon announced today that U.S. Navy warships will re-enter the Adriatic Sea. They'll begin a support mission backing United Nations efforts to get food and medicine into Bosnia. NPR's Neil Conan reports.
Pentagon spokesman Pete Williams said the helicopter carrier Iwo Jima and the guided missile cruiser Biddle are en route to the Adriatic to assist in humanitarian efforts. Williams said the ships would provide radar and communication support for flights into the besieged city of Sarajevo and could also provide search and rescue helicopters if necessary. The return of the U.S. Navy to the Adriatic will also send a political message. The Iwo Jima can carry Harrier jump jets and Cobra attack helicopters, but Williams specifically said only transport helicopters are aboard now, and he said the 1,700 Marines the ship carries are essentially along for the ride. The U.S., he repeated, sees no role for combat ground forces. The Secretary of Defense has spoken about providing air cover for U.N.-sponsored convoys if asked, but Williams said there has yet been no request from the U.N. This is Neil Conan in Washington.
On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 31 points to close at 3,324. This is NPR. Canadian soldiers assigned to the United Nations were welcomed today as they delivered 11 tons of food to a Muslim suburb near the Sarajevo airport. The 40,000 people in the suburb were reported to be nearly out of food when the delivery was made. Small arms clashes continued around the Bosnian capital today, and shells were fired into the center of the city. Three mortar rounds hit the UN compound, but no one was injured. A Canadian soldier was reported hurt today near the Sarajevo airport when he stepped on a landmine. Massachusetts' highest court has thrown out a racial bias complaint against Harvard Law School. Several student groups had tried to sue the school, alleging Harvard's hiring practices discriminate against minorities and women. David Wright of member station WBUR reports.
The decision, issued today by Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court, holds that students do not have legal standing to sue their school over its hiring practices. Only employees or would-be employees might be injured by any alleged discrimination, the court says, and therefore only they would have grounds to sue. The court rejected the students' arguments that the lack of many minority and women faculty members injures all students by depriving them of perspectives and potential role models. Students who had argued the case today expressed disappointment over the court's decision. Harvard Law School denies any allegations of discrimination. The school has 68 full-time faculty members, 7 are women, and 5 are black. For National Public Radio, this is David Wright in Boston.
Analysts in the retail industry said today that sales continued their slow growth in June. Department stores, which had been hard hit by the recession, reported better-than-expected results, as did some clothing stores. Even though some of the improvement was attributed to the return of warm weather, analysts said the growth showed consumers are becoming more willing to spend. Discount stores did better than department stores during the recession, but they showed some weakness now that the recovery seems to be underway. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Eileen Farrell is generally acknowledged to be the first opera singer to have a hit pop album. That was her 1960 recording, I've Got a Right to Sing the Blues. But more importantly, at the age of 72, Farrell is still considered by many to be the best example of an opera singer who truly understands what to do with American popular song. She has a new record of ballads called It's Over. Farrell is not only unpretentious as a pop singer, she was known for her unpretentiousness in the world of opera. She sang with the Met for 5 seasons and had a long, successful concert career. The music critic Winthrop Sargent once described Farrell as unquestionably one of the greatest dramatic sopranos alive today. Before we meet her, let's hear something from her new album, It's Over, on the label Reference Recordings. This is I'm Through With Love.
I'm through with love. I'll never fall again. Said adieu to love, don't ever call again. For I must have you or no one. And so I'm through with love. I've locked my heart, I'll keep my feelings there. I have stocked my heart with icy, frigid air, and I mean to care for no one, because I'm through with love.
What are some of the mistakes you think that some opera singers make when they try to sing pop?
Well, I think that, see, most singers, the voice is first with them.
What are some of the mistakes you think that some opera singers make when they try to sing pop?
Well, I think that, see, most singers, the voice is first with them. They're thinking of their voice all the time. And instead of paying attention to the words, they may be paying attention to the words, but they're also thinking of the voice. The voice is it. Well, I have never... Like my teacher always used to say, don't listen to yourself, because if you listen to yourself, you're going to get into trouble. In other words, you'll always hear yourself, but don't listen. Don't concentrate on how you sound, because you're listening to the final effect, what people are going to hear. So therefore, you're concentrating on the wrong thing. You should concentrate on what you have to do as far as your breath is concerned and as far as placing, you know, and I don't mean to use that word placing, but singing forward and using your breath. And if you concentrate on those things, the result is going to be there.
Your new album, It's Over, is one of a series of recent recordings that you've made on the label Reference Recordings.
Yes.
What got you back into doing these kinds of pop songs, you know, recording them?
Oh, well, let me see. 6 years ago, my husband died, and I just got into a real funk, and I didn't want to sing at all. I was very depressed. And Lunis McGlowan, who, as a matter of fact, Lunis and I had a show on...
NPR.
Yes, we did years ago, but we did 12 weeks. And So Luna kept saying to me, come on, you got to start singing. I said, no, I don't got to. I don't have to do anything I don't want to do at this time of my life. And he said, no, come on, you've got to sing. So I went down to, Luna's is in North Carolina. So I went down and we started fooling around with the piano and he would pick out a song. I mean, oh God, that's so sad. And I'd start to cry and I couldn't sing. So finally, I got a letter from Tam Henderson, who owns Reference Recordings, and just a note saying that he had a small company and he would like, he'd been a fan of mine for years and he would like to record me. So I thought, well, what have I got to lose? You know, I don't know if it's going to be good or bad. So I said, okay, we'll do one. So he went down to North Carolina and we, I forget the first one we did, I guess it was probably Harold Arlen because I love him so much. And we started to make these records, and lo and behold, I now have 7, and we're working on the 8th.
Great.
Yeah.
So you said you when you started to sing these songs again, you'd end up crying in the middle of songs.
Oh, honey, I still do.
Really?
Oh, God, yes. Yeah, because I love sad songs.
Was it always that way, or did that have something to do with your husband's death?
It was always that way. I mean, my husband's death had a great deal to do with it, of course. But for instance, I could never sing Butterfly. That music in Butterfly just pulverizes me. I just completely go to pieces. And I remember years ago, Eric Leinsdorf said that he wanted me to record Butterfly with him. And I said, I can't. He said, of course you can. I said, no, I cry. He said, that's the most stupid thing I've ever heard in my life. So we went into a studio and he started, you know, playing the Butterfly. And we got to such a spot. And all I have to hear is the music. I didn't even open my mouth yet. And the tears started. And he says, oh, you've got to stop that. I said, yeah, easy for you.
So what happened?
I didn't do it.
Did you ever start crying during a performance on stage?
No. The nearest thing I have, but I have to keep talking to myself all the time. You know, you can't do this, you can't do that. While I'm singing, I'm talking to myself. It was the Giancarlo Minotti's To This We've Come. That is pretty, that's a pretty tough message. And I have gotten caught up with that couple of times, but I got to the point where I said, well, you know, you just can't do this anymore. So, I mean, I can do the aria, but not get carried away by it.
Well, since you've mentioned it, why don't we hear that aria?
Oh, speaking of it.
Speaking okay. of it, this is from Giancarlo Minotti's opera, The Consul, and we'll hear you singing the aria To This We've Come with Thomas Schippers conducting the London Symphony Orchestra. Do you remember the making of this recording?
Oh, yes.
Did tears come to your eyes during this?
No, because I tell you, we were in London doing this, and Giancarlo he came to the recording session. And I was petrified. Here he is sitting there in the studio, and I can see him through the glass, and I'm singing his To This We've Come. And I thought, oh, God, I've got to do this right. And he's listening and listening, and he's so pensive looking. And I thought, oh, my God, I hope it comes out all right. So I was pretty on edge during that recording.
Okay. You're just joining us. My guest is Eileen Farrell. Let's go back to your childhood.
Oh.
Now your parents had a vaudeville act.
Yes,
the group
they
was
did.
Called the Singing O'Farrells.
That's right.
What was the act?
Well, my mother was a soprano. She, as a matter of fact, she was a coloratura. And I don't think she did that on the stage. I'm not so sure, but she was a soprano. My father was a high baritone. And my father also imitated bird whistles. He could whistle like anything.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah. And then my father played most all musical instruments, which they did. So, I mean, this was long before I came along. And but they did the East Coast circuit, and they were, I don't know how many years, but I still have some of their reviews, the singing O'Farrells.
So did they perform after you were born?
No, no. My mother was an organist in church. My mother taught piano and she taught voice, and my father, in order to earn a living for us kids, he was a house painter.
Who got serious about your voice first, your mother or
my
you?
Mother. My mother. Oh, me. Oh, that's the last thing in the world. I mean, I don't know. When I was in high school, I don't know whatever I thought I was going to be, but I had no ambitions to be anything, really. Nothing. Just to have a good time. And when I graduated from high school, my mother said, we used to get the New York Times every Sunday, and there was an ad singing teacher, and my mother knew her because my mother studied with the same teacher that she did. And so she said, we're going to go down and see if she thinks that, you know, you have a voice. We'll go to New York, because we were living in Rhode Island at that time. So we went to New York, and I was more excited to go to New York. That's a great, you know, that was wonderful. I'd never been there before. So I sang for this woman, and she said, yes, she'd take me. So I went back home, and it was in August. No, whenever. September, I guess it was. I went back to New York, and I studied with this woman, and I studied with her about 5 years. She didn't do me any harm, but she didn't correct me very much.
What needed correcting?
I don't know. See, because I found out later that I was her first pupil. Very much later. And she would say, well, now that sounds pretty good. You know, and I said, oh, I guess it's okay. But she would give me some, you know, vocalizings to do, and I did that. And then I had never learned German before, and I had to learn German. And I was learning sight reading, taking those lessons. And then I had to, if I was going to stay in New York, which to me I wasn't going to because I had never been away from home this long, and I told my mother I wasn't going to stay, and my mother said, oh, yes, you are. So I had to have a job in order to stay. So I went to CBS to audition to get into the chorus because that's about all I could, you know, do was sing.
This was CBS Radio.
CBS Radio, yes. This is in 1940.
Mm-hmm. So you auditioned to be in the chorus. You ended up with your own radio show, though.
That's right. I was in the chorus for about 3 months, and then they offered me my own radio show. Half-hour radio show once a week, and I was there for 7 years.
So what would you sing on your radio show?
It was a half-hour show. I would do one aria and at least one song in either German, French, or Italian. Then the orchestra would do a couple of numbers, and then I would sing something in English. And so therefore, it depended upon what the timing of the orchestra and my songs. So I did that because it was just a half-hour show. I did that every week for 7 years.
Did you have a theme?
Yes.
What was it?
It was Let My Song Fill Your Heart.
Uh-huh.
Ernest Charles wrote that years ago.
How did that go?
Let my song fill your heart with its melody, oh, so divine. And that's about all they ever heard.
And then an announcer came on.
That's
and said,
right.
Eileen Farrell.
Yeah, right. Here she is. Da, 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 da.
And who was your sponsor?
Oh, it was no sponsor.
No sponsor?
No. Oh, no, 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 no. That was, you know, strictly CBS. In those days, CBS did a tremendous amount of good music because they had the symphony. And they had several shows, I think, one, I forget what one was called. I was on, and several other people had their own shows, and they were not sponsored at all.
Mm-hmm. No, it was around 1940 that you started your radio show.
Right.
It was about 20 years later, in 1960, that you joined the Met.
Yes.
Can you give me a really quick sense of what happened in between?
From radio, I did concerts all over the place, concerts. Then I sang with orchestras, you know, doing arias with orchestra. And I did a lot of, I did some recordings. And I did quite a few TV things. I did a lot of Gary Moore shows.
Oh, yeah.
A lot of Ed Sullivan shows.
Yeah, yeah.
And then it was, I forget when it was that one day the phone rang and it was Mr. Bing. And he said to me, I've read several times that the reason you haven't, you are not at the Metropolitan is because you have never been asked. And I said, that's true. I never have been asked. So he says, well, I'm asking you. So that's how that started.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Eileen Farrell. And we're going to take a short break and then talk some more. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Eileen Farrell, the great opera singer and pop singer. She has a new album of standards called It's Over. You stayed with the Met for 5 seasons.
Yes.
What were the reasons behind your leaving?
Well, the last year I was there, he, being Mr. Bing, offered me 2 performances of Chenier. And then he asked me if I would do Wozzeck in English. And I said, no, I wouldn't do Wozzeck in English. I had done it in German, and I had recorded it in German, and I said, I'm not about to relearn an opera, because I had already done that many years ago with a Strauss opera, Ariadne, and it's very difficult, and I thought at this stage of the game, I'm not going to start doing that. So when I said no to him, I had a feeling that that was it. So the next season, Manager called him to say, you know, what do you have to offer next year? Because we have to plan concerts around it. And he said, we have nothing to offer her next year unless one of our foreign artists will relinquish a role to her, then she can have it. And I said to him, no thanks. I said to my manager, you tell him no thanks and take my name off the roster. So that's just the way it ended.
Were you very sorry?
Yes, I was. I loved singing opera. I loved it. But of course, I was doing so many other things. But today, when I'm not doing all these things, I think the thing I miss most is the opera, because I loved being on stage and I loved singing with other people. It's a wonderful experience.
When you came to opera, having been used to radio and to concert performance, what was newest to you that was the most challenging to get used to?
Memorizing. At least in radio, you know, I've got the music in front of me. I can't forget a word. I can't forget a note. But memorizing was kind of, it wasn't difficult for me, but I had to know it backwards and forwards, you know, and I used to learn it as a play. I used to speak it. I spoke all my lines before I ever sang them. And so that by the time I got to the music, I didn't have to worry about the words.
Right. So did you do that with jazz songs, too? Speak them first?
Naturally. But I know an awful lot of jazz music. I really do.
Yeah.
And if I find something, I always read the words first. Read the words first, because words are the most important thing. Breathing and words are the most important thing in singing. Because if you can't understand your words, I mean, you're just not getting your message across and nobody knows what you're talking about. You see, and I approach it as I'm talking, not that I'm singing, because I approach singing as I'm talking.
Many years ago, the writer Winthrop Sargent profiled you in the New Yorker magazine, and that became a chapter in his book Divas. And he wrote about you that, you know, Eileen Farrell had never had the passionate devotion to a career that inspires most divas. She was happier as a housewife, and he also wrote that you distrusted the opera world with all its exotic surroundings. How much of that do you think of as being true?
I think the first part is true. The second part is not true.
That it's true that you didn't have a passionate devotion to your career.
I didn't. I never had a passionate. What is the word? A passionate
devotion.
Devotion to anything. I don't think. I just look. As long as I was singing, that's all I cared for. I love to sing. That's my big thing. I just love to sing. And whatever I sing, I mean, I don't sing it unless I love to sing it.
You said that part of what Winthrop Sargent said wasn't true. Is that the part about distrusting the opera world?
Yeah. No, that's not true.
Yeah.
No, because I have so many friends that are in the opera world, yeah. And they're wonderful friends.
Now, you're not performing anymore.
No. I don't want to have the... tension. I don't want to have the nerves that I get now that I'm older.
You're more nervous now as a performer than you were when you were younger?
Oh, yes.
Why is that?
I don't know. I just don't know. I mean, in singing in front of people, I am. But like a whole audience. But doing a recording, that's an awful lot of fun. Because you're in a studio and you've got some guys in the orchestra that's sitting there and they're playing and if I'm not with the orchestra, I'm with a trio, and it's a lot of fun. It's very relaxed, you know, and I move around, and I, you know, it's great. It's very rewarding. See, and I'm happy because I'm singing, and that's all that matters is that I sing.
Listen, of all the Ed Sullivan shows that you've done,
yeah.
Which one really stands out in your mind?
Oh God. Well, one night he called me Eileen O'Farrell.
Well, that's your original name, right?
No, that was my original name is Eileen Farrell.
But your parents were the singing O'Farrell.
Yeah, I know. They used the O.
Oh, they just used it. I see.
Yeah.
Right.
Because now I found out that O means the son of. since I've been to Ireland 3 times. Oh, it's such a wonderful place. But anyway, to get back to what?
Sullivan.
Oh, yeah. And then... because, you know, you do it in all one day. You get there at 8 o'clock in the morning, and then you rehearse, and then you have to tape it in the afternoon so he could watch it. And then you do it again at night, and that's live, you know. And so that Sunday is just terrible. So I had rehearsed, and then it came, we taped it for the dress rehearsal. And then after the dress rehearsal, after he heard the tape, he said, I don't like that pop. Because I always used to sing an aria and a pop tune.
Uh-huh.
He said, I don't like that tune. And I thought, well, tough, buddy. You know, it's Sunday. So that meant that they had to get the orchestrations down to the theater. And everybody had gone out to get their dinner before 8 o'clock, see? And I'm just sitting there, and I had to find another song that Ed would approve of. So he approved of one, so we passed out all the music, and then I sang that. And he said, yeah, that'll be okay. So then I, you know, try to get my nerves settled down, and then that night I went out, and he introduced me, and I sang the aria, and then he introduced that I was going to sing such and such a song, and it was the song that he didn't want me to sing.
Oh, so what'd you do?
At that point, I didn't know what I was going to sing. I hadn't the slightest idea what that song was that we had changed to. I tell you, that was a moment of really, I could have died. Oh, I could have killed him. I could have killed him. So the orchestra started the introduction, and the Lord was with me because I recognized from the introduction, and I started to sing, and I sang the whole thing. Well, I had I guess five or six shows to do with him, and I canceled the rest of them. I think I cannot go through this. Life is too short. But he was a very funny man, though, you know, and he didn't know it.
Yeah.
It's true.
So that was your last Sullivan show?
Yeah, sure was.
Wow.
It sure was. But I did a lot before that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, Eileen Farrell, it's been just a great pleasure to talk with you.
Thank you.
I thank you very much.
Well, I thank you for asking me.
Eileen Farrell's new album, It's Over, is on Reference Recordings. This is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
from Philadelphia. I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, the politics behind the development, testing, and marketing of drugs to treat AIDS. We'll talk to health economist Peter Arno. He says that AIDS activists, critical of the slow-moving FDA approval process, have sparked major changes in the way new drugs are tested and released. Also, tenor saxophonist Clifford Jordan has put out a new live album with his big band. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead has a review. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. Soon-to-be Democratic presidential nominee Bill Clinton has named his vice presidential choice, Senator Albert Gore of Tennessee. NPR's Mara Liasson reports from Little Rock.
Bill Clinton has chosen Tennessee Senator Al Gore for the second spot on the Democratic ticket. It's unusual to choose two candidates from the same part of the country, but the Democrats say the pair of border state politicians will help them take advantage of the uncertainties of a three-way race to break the Republican stranglehold on the South. Gore, like Clinton, is young, and the campaign hopes the two baby boomers will appeal to younger voters. Clinton campaign aides say of all Gore's qualities, perhaps the most important is that Gore has been tested. Gore ran for the presidential nomination himself in 1988, and although he didn't get very far, his experience in that crucible gives Clinton assurance that with Gore there will be no surprises. In Little Rock, I'm Mara Liasson.
President Bush met with the president of Bosnia today and afterward told European leaders that aid should be sent to that nation no matter what it takes. Mr. Bush also indicated that he would consider using U.S. air power against Serbian artillery. Speaking today to the Conference on Security and Cooperation in Europe, the president said the U.S. will keep substantial military force in Europe. According to Secretary of State James Baker, while Mr. Bush did not propose a military response to what he termed the nightmare in Bosnia, he said that he would consider a call for U.S. air power. On Capitol Hill, the House has sent President Bush a bill that for the first time in the history of the federal college loan program will make middle and upper income families eligible for government aid. NPR's Claudio Sanchez reports.
The Higher Education Amendment Act would allow a family of four earning over $35,000 and up to $70,000 a year to drop their home or farm equity and college savings accounts from their list of assets when calculating their financial need. Also, if the bill is fully funded, poor and disadvantaged students would get slightly larger grants, and the size of the average loan would increase by $500 to $1,000. But the bill's most sweeping proposal is to eliminate banks and financial institutions from the college aid program. Beginning in 1994, the Department of Education will disperse millions of financial aid dollars directly to as many as 250 colleges and universities as part of a five-year pilot program to see if it saves the government money. The new student aid program would cost $22 billion a year, $9 billion more than today. President Bush is expected to sign the bill next week. I'm Claudio Sanchez in Washington.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up more than 30 points to close at 3,324.08 on volume of over 208 million shares. This is NPR News. In South Africa, the African National Congress has turned down a government call to resume talks broken off after a recent mass murder in a black township. ANC leader Nelson Mandela said there can be no meetings until the government acts to end violence and eases its stand on a new constitution. Mandela charged that the government of South Africa is only interested in protecting the concerns of the white minority. Columbia sailed through a clear Florida sky and landed at the Kennedy Space Center this morning, setting a record for the longest space shuttle flight. Because of bad weather, the landing had to be changed from California to Florida. Dave Pignanelli of member station WMFE reports.
Shuttle Commander Dick Richards carefully glided NASA's oldest orbiter to a smooth landing at the Kennedy Space Center. The clear blue sky over Florida was quite a contrast to weather conditions in California. The shuttle was originally scheduled to land at Edwards Air Force Base, but wet, cloudy conditions in the California desert forced NASA to choose the Florida landing site instead. Columbia rolled to a stop with the aid of a new red, white, and blue drag chute, which helped slow the shuttle's roll. That's just one of several modifications that Columbia has undergone in preparation for this mission. The most notable change was the installation of additional fuel tanks, which allowed Columbia to stay in space longer than any previous shuttle mission. Today's touchdown brings to an end 14 days in orbit, which NASA hopes will eventually lead to a year-round manned space station. For National Public Radio, I'm Dave Pignanelli reporting.
Longtime CBS newsman Eric Severide has died. He was 79 years old and had been suffering from cancer. In 29 years at CBS, Severide was a war correspondent, radio news broadcaster, and television commentator. In 1940, he was the first newsman to report that France was about to surrender to the Germans. Eric Severide retired from CBS in 1977. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Everyone who has AIDS hopes a cure will be found before it's too late for them. People with AIDS have been frustrated by the length of time it's taken for new AIDS-related drugs to be approved and how much they cost once they hit the market. Health economist Peter Arno says we can learn a lot from analyzing how the government and pharmaceutical companies have responded to the AIDS epidemic. Arno is the author of Against the Odds, the story of AIDS drug development, politics, and profits. AIDS activists have criticized the Food and Drug Administration for tying up new drugs in long, bureaucratic testing procedures while people desperate for help die. I asked Peter Arno why the regular testing procedures were too slow for AIDS drugs.
At one level, one could say that the research apparatus in this country was operating to an extent as business as usual, and there was no great super initiative to speed that up. And that was part of the bone of contention between AIDS patients and their allies and the establishment. The other was that within that business as usual setup, the NIH did establish a national clinical trials apparatus in the mid-80s to do AIDS clinical research. But that was set up de novo from scratch, and there was a huge time lag in establishing that and getting it working, and it's still a very large and slowly moving bureaucracy.
You said that a good example of a drug that went wrong, in the testing process or in the release process, is the drug aerosol pentamidine, which is a drug that's used for one of the most common opportunistic infections, associated with AIDS, and that's pneumocystic pneumonia. What went wrong with the release of this drug?
Well, essentially, it was a drug that had been around for 50 years and been used for a variety of things, from African sleeping sickness to treating malnourished and immunocompromised children. And in the 1970s, it was tested actually in double-blind, placebo-controlled trials for the treatment of pneumocystis pneumonia. Now, it wasn't pneumocystis pneumonia in AIDS patients, but it was pneumonia in immunocompromised patients. And those trials were definitive in demonstrating that the drug worked. Yet when AIDS came along in the 1980s, and pentamidine was the drug of choice for a good many physicians who were treating AIDS patients at the time without any approval from FDA, it was felt that since most of the pneumonias that people were getting with AIDS were in the lungs, that perhaps a more effective mechanism might be to aerosolize the drug and get it right to the lung directly. So they started aerosolizing this drug, and they tried to get the government's clinical trial structure to run these trials. They lumbered along for several years debating back and forth, how are we going to do this drug, what size nebulizer, many, many, many debates, and they couldn't get it off the ground. So finally, the drug was tested in a community setting, both in San Francisco and New York, and it was the data from those community trials, not the government-funded big clinical trial structure, that led to the approval of aerosolized pentamidine for as a prophylaxis against AIDS. And so that marked a milestone, I think, for community-based research.
How much of the community-based testing has caught on now? I mean, how much is that being relied on now for the testing of AIDS drugs?
In terms of money, in terms of how the money's allocated, it's a relatively small proportion of the total clinical trial effort. I'd say probably maybe between 15 and 20% of clinical trial dollars are going to these community-based clinical trial sites. But there are some advantages. They do include more women and minorities than the larger clinical trials are able to do. B, they're cheaper to run from than the larger sites. They have much lower overhead rates. And three, they're more cognizant and flexible in terms of allowing other drugs that people might be taking for a variety of conditions. And they also demonstrate more perhaps than the larger clinical trials the real-world efficacy of taking a drug in a community as opposed to in a strictly scientific clinical trial.
In your assessment of the official medical structure for testing new drugs, how much of the problem do you think is bureaucracy, and how much of it is just to really safely test a drug takes a long time?
I would say that the bureaucracy that has been established is slow-moving and ineffective largely, primarily because we have a lack of leadership in this country in dealing with the AIDS epidemic, and we've had that lack of leadership from the beginning of the epidemic, and very little has changed in the last 12 years to correct that.
Do you think that good leadership would have said, listen, this isn't business as usual, a kind of special, quick procedure needs to be developed for getting new drugs into the public?
Let me give you a very specific example of how the lack of leadership stymies AIDS drug development.
Yeah.
Right now, we're faced with a situation where, in all likelihood, we will not have a magic bullet to cure AIDS. What we will have is a combination of drugs that will be effective in prolonging people's lives, perhaps treat that AIDS will become a chronic illness, much like diabetes or hypertension. But it will require a combination of drugs. What you need is a structure that allows a number of drug companies to come to the table with the federal government, with the federal researchers, and design trials that where everyone works together and everything's coordinated. Well, that's the most difficult thing to do when you have no leadership from the White House to the Secretary of Health and Human Services on down. You need to have the force of leadership to make those kinds of things happen. Even the head of the National Institute for Allergy and Infectious Diseases, Tony Fauci, does not have that kind of authority or power to make those things happen easily.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Peter Arno, co-author of the new book Against the Odds, The Story of AIDS Drug Development, Politics, and Profits. We're going to take a short break and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Just joining us, my guest is Peter Arno, author of a new book about AIDS drug development. He's a health economist and associate professor at Montefiore and Albert Einstein. Let's talk about the pricing of AIDS-related drugs. When AZT first went on the market, I believe it would cost somebody $10,000 a year. At $10,000 a year, was there something about ingredients in the drug or the difficulty of manufacturing it that could explain that exorbitant price? Or did it have more to do with politics?
I think the main rationale for the high price of the drug was the same rationale that's used in pricing any drug, and that is to maximize profits for its manufacturer, Burroughs Wellcome. The unique nature of this drug was that they rightly or wrongly assumed at that time that there would be new drugs coming on the market within the next year or two. and that that would they had to make their money back for the development of AZT rather quickly. It turned out that it took 5 years for the next antiviral drug to be brought to market. So that in, by itself was totally a fallacious assumption. But moreover, they also argued that it cost tremendous amounts of money to research and develop this drug, which is, in my view, and we lay out clearly in the book why and how that's exactly not true, that in fact AZT was developed primarily by researchers in the National Cancer Institute with federal tax dollars, and they demonstrated for the very first time the efficacy of AZT against the AIDS virus. And the ironic thing is that the Burroughs Wellcome Company was brought into the development of AIDS drugs rather reluctantly, because they argued that it was a disease that affected very few people, and how could they devote the kinds of resources that they, millions of dollars, needed to bring a drug to market for such a rare disease. And to date, the Burroughs Wellcome Company has generated over $1.2 billion in revenues from this drug.
In 1983, there was something passed called the Orphan Drug Act, and this was supposed to help spur on research for drugs related to diseases that were not common diseases, so that the drug companies couldn't expect to sell a whole lot of the drug, because as dangerous as the disease was, it might be a rare disease. Was AIDS research helped by the Orphan Drug Act? Why don't you spell out first what the act
did? The Orphan Drug Act was signed into law by Ronald Reagan in 1983, and basically it was designed to stimulate the development of drugs for rare diseases, because up until that time, drug companies were not very interested in, and it was not profitable for them to develop drugs that affected relatively few people. And what the Orphan Drug Act did was gave drug companies a series of tax credits and research grants, as well as exclusive licensing provisions that would hopefully would stimulate the development of drugs for rare diseases. I should point out that despite the fact that the vast majority of these rare diseases affect relatively few people, there are some 5,000 rare diseases in this country that affect some 20 million people. So it affects a substantial number of people, but it's divided into a large number of illnesses. And there have been, since 1983, some 500 drugs that have been designated as orphan drugs. Of those 500 drugs, some 70 drugs have been brought to market. And most people would agree that the act, for the most part, has been successful. The problem has been that there are a small number of drugs, probably 10% of them, that that really have abused the intent of the act. They haven't broken the law per se, but what they've done is there are now, to my count, at least six orphan drugs that generate over $100 million a year in sales. And the act was very specific in its intent, that it was for drugs that were not commercially viable.
Well, what's the harm of a drug like pentamidine being still coming under the Orphan Drug Act?
What the Orphan Drug Act says, that the manufacturer will have sole, exclusive licensing, marketing rights to that drug for 7 years. And with pentamidine, as an example, there was a number of drug company sponsors that were willing to market the drug, that had done the clinical test, that had done the basic research, and they were forbidden from coming to market. So they were forbidden, essentially, from having some competition, which theoretically and hopefully would have led to lower prices. It's the issue of pricing, really, that's the heart of this. AZT came out at a higher price. AZT was an orphan drug. It's like a direct transfer from the American taxpayer to the pockets of the drug industry.
As a medical professional, do you have mixed feelings about AIDS activists? You've praised the activist community for creating many important innovations within medical research, but I wonder if you ever resist the activism as someone who's part of the medical profession yourself.
You know, I think history is going to be very kind to the AIDS activists of the 1980s and 1990s. In the early 80s, when government largely was defective in providing services to people with AIDS, community-based groups, largely established by many gay men in New York City and San Francisco and cities across the country, developed innovative service delivery systems that are now being copied for other diseases and chronic diseases of the elderly. So on the one hand, they came in on the service side in the early 80s when that was not being delivered. And by the mid-80s, they focused much of their activism on pushing the government to develop and put resources into new drug development and getting those new drugs on the market faster. And just look at the FDA. The FDA has come a long, long way since the early 80s when it fumbled around with the approval of a variety of AIDS drugs, could not make up its mind. The drug ganciclovir comes to mind, where they knew the drug worked. Every eye doctor in this country that was treating AIDS patients knew the drug worked, and yet they could not find a way to approve it because it didn't meet the exact standards at the time. And the FDA has moved along. They have now proposed regulations both for a parallel track initiative and an accelerated approval initiative.
How do you think that people with other illnesses might benefit in the future from the protests and the activist work that AIDS activists have done over the past few years?
I think one of the most illustrative services that has been accomplished by AIDS activists has been a spotlight they have put on the pharmaceutical industry on the pricing of drugs. Drug prices have increased three times the rate of consumer goods in the 1980s. It's the fastest growing component of healthcare costs in this country. And while the industry proudly proclaims that it spends $9 billion a year on research and development, what they don't tell the U.S. public is that they spend $10 billion a year on marketing and advertising. If you price a drug high, what you do is you make it inaccessible to many people that need it. More than 50% of the pharmaceuticals in this country are paid for out of pocket, and it hits the elderly is harder than any other group. It's probably the largest single cost item for the elderly in their daily living. And the health insurance payments are not enough to cover pharmaceuticals. They're very poorly covered, in fact, by the insurance industry.
Peter Arno is the author of Against the Odds. He's an associate professor at the Montefiore Medical Center and Albert Einstein College of Medicine in New York City. This is Fresh Air. Linda Wertheimer's with us. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Linda, do you have a lot to tell us about Al Gore?
Absolutely. Senator Albert Gore of Tennessee. We're going to have a profile, which Nina Totenberg is doing. Mara Liasson is in Little Rock, and she will be reporting on the announcement itself. We're also going to be talking to some voters, some of the voters that we've talked to in the course of covering the campaign so far, to see what they think of the choice of Albert Gore of Tennessee to be the vice presidential running mate for Governor Clinton. And we have a few other stories on the show today, Terry, as well as listener letters.
Thanks, Linda. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. In the world of New York jazz clubs, Mondays are for big bands. There's one at the Village Vanguard, which continues the work of the late drummer Mel Lewis. Another at Sweet Basil plays the music of the late Gil Evans. The band at Condon's is led by Clifford Jordan. They have a new album. Jordan fan Kevin Whitehead has a review.
Jazz band works one night a week at the same club, the way Clifford Jordan's does at Condon's. A social atmosphere develops among regulars who come to listen with one ear and hang out with the other. Whatever else jazz is, it's a social music. In a setting like that, you don't want the music to be too subtle. Jordan's 15-piece band doesn't break new ground, but they swing hard. Their intonation gets blurry, but Jordan obviously wants it loose and boisterous. If there's one thing Wynton Marsalis has shown jazz, it's how dull perfection can be. That's from Jordan's new live album, Down Through the Years, recorded last fall for Milestone. The record does what it should do, which is showcase Clifford Jordan, a true master of the tenor saxophone. Like Coleman Hawkins or Sonny Rollins, he's tinkered with the sound as he's gotten older to keep from repeating himself. His tones become more harsh and edgy, more pitiless. And if that makes his ballads a shade less heartbreaking, he's better equipped to spearhead this band. Jordan isn't the only good soloist in his band, which includes trumpeter Dizzy Reese, pianist Ronnie Matthews, and the king of the jazz euphonium, Kayani Zawadi. Still, the pieces Jordan dominates are best, and he rightly claims more solo space than anyone else. I mean, why go through the headaches of having your own band if you're not going to indulge yourself?
Kevin Whitehead is a jazz critic and record annotator in New York. He wrote the discography for the new edition of The Jazz Book, published by Lawrence Hill. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Joan Tuohy, and Roberta Shurrock, with Sue Weinstein and Deborah Beagle. Research assistance from Ellen Silva. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by this and other NPR member stations. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
The Democratic presidential and vice presidential hopefuls are both members of the Democratic Leadership Council, a group whose goal has been to move the party toward the center. On the next Fresh Air, we'll examine the politics of the Democratic Leadership Council. Also, we meet the Hudlin brothers, who directed and produced Eddie Murphy's new movie, Boomerang. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.